Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you so much for joining us on the program every Sunday, 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com. And we also have the radio shows page where we archive these programs and we link to our guests' websites. And we'll be giving you that link here in just a moment. Today's program, very interesting. And it's one subject that I absolutely enjoy because it helps me to better understand, and I'm curious about the whole aspect, but it's a specific area that we're going to be talking about with our guest, Dr. Jessica Zitter, who is the author of Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. And Jessica, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is a subject, as far as California is concerned, just recently, if I am not mistaken, we just passed a, I think they call it a right to die law, where if you get to a certain point, and I guess this is usually in terms of individuals who are terminal and what have you, and they want to make that decision to and I use the term transition, that they now have the law behind them to say, yes, you can do that if you choose to do so. And a very quick story I want to share with you, and I want you to share with us your concepts or your opinions on this. A friend of mine was caregiving to a 94-year-old woman who was just a wonderful woman. She wasn't terminal. She wasn't having any psychological or mental issues. She just reached a point where she went to this friend of mine and said, I'm done. I have done all I want to do in this world. I want to go. And she assisted her after several, I think, weeks of conversation in that process. And this was many years ago. And no, the guy's name was not Jack Kevorkian, but he really opened the door in that regard. But we're talking here more in terms of issues of a medical nature, because as an ICU and palliative care specialist, you basically are asking how we can find a better way to die. And I'm hoping, folks, that you will listen and you'll even pick up a copy of Extreme Measures. Share with us your perspectives on this aspect, especially when it comes to the medical profession that is taught, never say never. Let's just keep on going. We'll find a way to keep you alive when, in fact, maybe there comes a point when, you know, it's time to let you go. It's time. I want to go. Please let me go.
Well, you know, I'm an ICU doctor. I started out in intensive care unit medicine because I love saving lives, and I really believe in it, and it's one of my favorite parts of the job, honestly. But what I noticed was that, you know, too much of the time we were applying these same aggressive technologies to patients who were really approaching the end of their lives, and for whom I worried that the burdens of these treatments were actually going to outweigh the benefits, and I wanted to, you know, but we just did it by default, and I saw a lot of suffering, and that's when I found the field of palliative care. Palliative care medicine is a field which really values patient choice and allowing patients to live the way they want to live all the way until the end. And so I learned a whole set of skills of communication, of breaking bad news, of helping people to understand the various options ahead of them. And what I found, and also obviously to treat symptoms and keep patients comfortable, what I found was that when patients usually are approaching the end of their lives, whether it's from frailty, being old, having terminal illness, having serious illness, a lot of patients, when they understand these realities, when their doctors share that information with them, don't choose to be placed on life-prolonging treatments and machinery. They prefer not to. They prefer to live their lives as long as they can, but with maximal quality of life. And that's something that we're very focused on doing in palliative care. And I've seen a lot of patients just really, really benefit from it. And so what I'm an advocate for is maximizing information, maximizing patient-centered decision-making, and bringing the patient into the conversation so that they can decide what we should do next instead of just assuming that we should be putting default treatments on everybody.
And I find it interesting, too, in the 21st century that we're beginning to understand that I'll call it the art and or the science of medicine, is an individualized element. that no one treatment is a cure-all for all people who have been diagnosed with a similar or same condition or syndrome or what have you, or dis-ease. And the same thing seems to apply in this case as well, that no one answer, you know, it's like, okay, we've got a supply of 500,000 shots of the medication, if you will, that will send you into the next world, because some folks, they just need to, they need the pain taken away, even though they know this. And I'm wondering, how has our educational system failed us in this regard in terms of dealing with this? Because I know of other cultures. I remember seeing a documentary on death and dying in different cultures around the world. One in particular, I think it was in South America, where the documentary crew was actually told, you must leave the village because we will not be able to protect you as we go into this next phase of the grieving process, which apparently becomes very aggressive, very agitated and so forth. And it's just what they do. But they have these ways in these other cultures of dealing with this. How has our system, our civilization in the West, sort of let us down in that regard to where we have so much difficulty dealing with this subject?
Well, I think it's a really good question. We've basically gotten distracted by the recent rise in technology that really started in the 1930s, 1940s with the iron lung, and we've glommed onto it as a miracle cure that, that machinery is going to save us from this thing that we all fear so much, which is death. We, you know, no one wants to die, and somehow there's this machinery, and we sort of hold it up. You look at our, you know, TV shows like Grey's Anatomy and ER, and we believe in these machines. And so I think we've gotten distracted from death in this culture. We just keep looking for something else, and thinking that there's something out there that's going to save us from death. And so instead of sitting down and thinking about death as it's approaching, we're still looking for that next catheter, that next breathing machine. And so we're not making our preparations, and we're just treating everybody, again, with this cookie-cutter approach of maximum use of life support and machinery, which it turns out, honestly, people don't want. When you look at the surveys about patients who actually get information and have these end-of-life conversations with their physicians, they are much less likely to choose aggressive interventions than those who never have conversations. And so we are sticking our heads in the sand a little bit and not doing the preparation that will allow us to guide our own care.
This program is all about choices. We're trying to give people choices and knowledge of those choices to help make their dreams come true, to help whatever those dreams might be. My wife faced cancer back in 2001. She was diagnosed. She was told she needed surgery and then chemo. And I got to a point where I said, you need to make a choice. You need to decide whether you're going to. And I literally asked her this question this way. Do you want to live or do you want to die? Now, I didn't know that she had made this, asked herself this question several weeks earlier. But I said, and I may not like your choice, but I will support you in it, whatever it is. So I'm just wondering, isn't there a point at which, and I ask this question of a lot of different things, but in this case, just because we can, does that mean we should? And in terms of the examples you even brought up, especially as you referred to going back in history in reference to the iron lung, just because we can keep you alive, does that mean we should? And is that a violation of the Hippocratic Oath?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, I would argue, and I'm sure there are people who would argue with me when I say this, but I would argue that if you have a young person who gets polio, for example, and has this virus in her body that's preventing her from being able to breathe, I would say, yes, we should. That person should be put on a breathing machine, period, end of discussion. And we should do everything we can to support that person until that virus resolves and hopefully they regain their strength and are able to breathe on their own again. I think it is a different question, and I would say the same thing about a young trauma victim or somebody who comes in with a terrible infection, or, you know, those are people that, I mean, you know, they're previously, they're healthy, they're young, there's a likelihood, a reasonable likelihood that they can be supported by machinery until their bodies recover and spring back. The only situation where I think it's questionable, and then we need to defer to the patient's preference is in situations where it's questionable about whether or not our machines have any chance of helping that person. So those are for people who are, you know, the elderly, the frail, the terminally ill, the critically ill. In situations like that, that's when we need to really bring the person, or at least their surrogates, into the conversation and ask. So there are some situations where I don't even think you honestly need to ask. I think a young polio victim, you just do it. But a person who may actually have significant burdens and possibly no significant benefit if they're already dying from an underlying disease, those people, really, the decisions need to be based on their own personal preferences, informed personal preferences. So it's two different categories in a way.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with the author of Extreme Measures. Her name is Jessica Zitter. She's an MD, and the subtitle is Finding a Better Way, a Better Path to the End of Life. I'm curious as to when and how you came to this place. And I know, I don't know, maybe it was an instantaneous epiphany that you had, or it was a gradual educating of self that has brought you to where you are today, as far as especially this particular work, but this place where you stand saying, look, we need to show greater we show greater respect for our animals, for our dogs and cats, than we do for human beings, as you know, from my perspective. So when and how did this change for you?
I'm embarrassed to tell you the answer to that, which is it took me longer than I would have wanted. You know, I really started out being so sure that the right thing to do is just save life. I mean, that's all that I had all those images from the media of, you know, these rescuing doctors, and my family, there were a lot of really, you know, intensive surgeons, and I just thought that was the way you took care of people, was to just do everything against all odds to try to bring them back to life. And, you know, I went in, and my medical training and most people's medical training supported that it was all about physiology and the individual organ and maximizing response of that organ. And so, you know, I was just so blinded by that approach and that philosophy that even though I was seeing a lot of suffering, it took me many years, and it took me a very, very assertive nurse who I ultimately ended up becoming very good friends with. In fact, I just saw her a few days ago at a conference, who basically, I'd say in a way, kind of slapped me around and said, hey, what are you doing? And it all of my doubts that I had been building, although I didn't have any other ways of approaching it, they all came together with her, and I finally said, oh my goodness, you're right. Teach me another way. And she was part of the early movement of the palliative care movement, even before it was officially a subspecialty.
And I know this may drift slightly from the general topic, but I'm curious as to your perspective on the pro-life movement. And again, the interesting thing about it is that people are not aware it is not just about the unborn. It is also about this subject that we're talking about, as well as the subject of euthanasia and choosing one's day and time. I've heard it said that we all have a round trip ticket. Okay, we know when it's punched when we leave. In other words, come to this world, this reality. We just don't know what the departure date and time is. And it's like, well, why can't I choose that? Somebody else chose my arrival. Why can't I choose my departure? And so forth. So I'm just curious, because our society, and especially here in the United States, and it's probably true in other countries as well, where there are certain conditions under which we will not preserve life. We will not go that extra mile. And that's all based more times than not on an individual's behavior or beliefs, or, you know, attitudes, those kinds of things. And so I'm curious as to, if you choose to, share with us your perspectives on the broader perspective of life and preserving it versus, if it is even versus, what we're talking about here today.
Well, I'm glad you asked. I am, let me put it in bright light, I'm against assault and battery. That would be I guess that's how I would say first and foremost. I believe, you know, people mistakenly think that there's palliative care is advocating for hastening death, which it is absolutely not. Palliative care advocates for persons' ability to refuse treatment if they don't think that it will be of benefit or it doesn't fit with their own personal preferences and values, and also respects people who do choose to continue to be treated with treatments if that's consistent with their own personal preferences. So what I felt as an ICU doctor, just treating without knowing a person's preferences, just putting people on machines who I hadn't spoken to and asked specifically, is this okay with you, when they really had a good chance of not having any significant improvement on these machines, but just continuing on them until they die, that felt like assault and battery. And I still do it because it's sort of what's, if I don't know, if someone hasn't actively opted out of that type of treatment, then the default treatment still is, and I think it should be, to do it, because, you know, you err on the side of prolonging life if you don't know. And I'm sure that would make people feel horrified to know that that's our default practice, but it is our default practice in the intensive care unit. We will keep you alive unless you have actively opted out of being attached to machines. And I don't think people understand that reality, that's the reality of an ICU doctor like me. But that's why I'm so passionate about educating people about what's happening, so that people can say, let me think about that. You know what? I might not want that. If I was in a situation where I wasn't likely to come back or to wake up, or I wouldn't want my body to be kept alive on machines. I want people to understand that that's the practice we're doing. And if you don't think you would want that, you need to clarify that with your loved ones and the people around you.
How has this changed you in terms of the experiences you have had, and I'm sure that you have been present at that time, with people who take that last breath?
Well, it completely depends on how it went. Was it, you know, done in a way that was consistent with their own personal values? Did they live up until the end the way they wanted to live? In situations where someone did, I feel peace for them. I feel a peace for them. In situations where they didn't, or I worry that they didn't, I feel a lot of heartache. So it depends. I mean, everyone dies. And so if everyone dies, I think that what I hope for is that most of those deaths are going to be done in ways that are really fitting with who that person is as a person.
My father has always said, over the course of his 86 years, that nobody gets out of this world alive. And so he would then say, so eat, drink, and be merry in moderation. And enjoy your life. And so I've tried to live by that as much as is possible. And maybe that's the reason why my parents are in their mid-80s and still going strong, because they've taken that philosophy to heart as well. This is, I don't mean to be overly graphic here, but here to me, there's one case in particular that went on, I think it was during the 90s. Of a young woman who lay in what was considered a vegetative state for, I don't know, it must have been several years. And the pro-life movement was really working hard to keep her on the equipment. And the husband says, no, she's gone. We need to unplug her. And when the autopsy was done after her death, her body shutting down, they did an autopsy, and her brain consisted basically of pudding. Now, that doesn't happen overnight. And this is one of those situations that is a hard one when you've got somebody who is in that kind of a condition. And yet we've had just the reverse happen as well, where someone's been in a vegetative state for years and all of the sudden wakes up. So these are really hard decisions for not only the medical community, but the caregivers, the family, and so forth to make, because honestly, you just don't know.
You know, there is uncertainty in medicine. And perfect certainty, honestly, about someone's prognosis is only achieved really if they're imminently dying or dead. And the problem with that is if you're going to withhold information until you have perfect certainty, which everybody would feel more comfortable with, right? You don't want to say big news that might be wrong, so people withhold it. Doctors withhold it. Patients don't want to hear it. They want to have perfect certainty. And so what happens is people don't know that someone's dying often until they're about to die, or maybe until they've died.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally think that that does a huge disservice to our society. I think we doctors need to accept, and I think patients too, to accept that there is an inherent level of uncertainty in this world, in this life. It's particularly so when you get into places like the intensive care unit where someone has disease. And we still should all want to be having honest conversations with the doctors, and the doctors should want to be sharing their honest thoughts with the patients and families about what direction things are likely to go, because even with the true transparency that, look, I'm not a soothsayer, but this is my experience based on decades of clinical experience, I think that information is still important for families to have, because, you know, if we sit and wait for that miracle cure, that unlikely waking up after 10 years in a coma, we often are doing things that many people would never want to do. They wouldn't want to take that chance of living attached to machines for some hope that something very, very unlikely could happen. And by the way, you know, the data on people waking up from comas, it's very rare. And it's almost always in situations where it's a young person who's had some sort of trauma. And again, extremely, extremely rare if it happens at all. But, you know, for people who've had massive strokes or who've had, a very common thing called anoxic encephalopathy, you know, after a cardiac arrest where their brain was starved of oxygen, those people are almost, you know, you can pretty much guarantee that they will not wake up. It's a very small percentage and a subset of people with comas who have any chance of waking up, and it usually relates to trauma, head trauma, and it's very rare if it happens at all.
Wow.
So to hang on that hope for a miracle cure, some people might be willing to, and many others would say, no, those odds are just not good enough for me to have my body hooked up to machines forever. It's very personal. It's a personal choice, but the conversation needs to be had.
And I'm glad we're having it here. And before we lose track of our time here, I will share also another point that we want to touch upon here in the last few moments. My grandmother was a wonderful woman who I remember took me as a child to a drive-in theater outside or in the area of Florence, Arizona, where I was born and raised in Phoenix, but that's where she lived. And we went to see a wonderful movie called The Sound of Music. Well, several years after her husband's passing, she was visiting us for Thanksgiving, and that evening they showed The Sound of Music on TV. So she got to watch her favorite movie, and then we all went to bed. Mm-hmm. According to one of my sisters, my grandmother got up in the middle of the night. She went in, went to the bathroom, came back, laid down, and we all woke up the next morning, and she had passed. Now, to that, she got to watch her favorite movie. She got to be around one of her daughters, her son-in-law, and her grandchildren in a warm, comfortable bed, and was able to, in essence, just let go because there was no real issue with her health. And so this seems to be the number one fear. It's not the fear of death. It's the fear of dying alone.
Well, two things that she was lucky about. Number one, it sounds very, very peaceful and comfortable from a physical and probably emotional perspective. But the other reason she was lucky is because there was no ethical, what do we do and what should we do, and family stress. And, you know, you were all lucky. And it sounds like it was peaceful on so many fronts.
Mm-hmm.
Nice story.
And the other beautiful thing was that we were able to experience that. Now, I think I was 7 at the time. And though I didn't have the emotional response, maybe it just didn't click in at that time, But the evening of the, I think it was the evening of the funeral, my mother nearly had me removed from the church because I was so upset. I was very close to her. And in subsequent years, I had the most amazing dream where I was doing a couple of things. One, driving, which I wasn't doing at the time. I didn't have the vision for it. And then I went and drove into this meadow where there's this beautiful house, and she was inside. Not a word was said, and she just gave me a hug. And that was one of the most beautiful experiences I can ever remember. And so I think that my parents, and they handled it, there was no trauma. Children, leave the room. You know, those kinds of things. You know, we don't want you to see this. They didn't do that to us. And I commend them for that. I am so grateful for what my parents, if there's anything that they that could leave me in their will, it would be nothing more than the wonderful lessons and experiences that they allowed us as a family to experience together. Jessica, before we let you go, three final questions and a reminder, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. Jessica Zitter, MD, is my guest. And my last three questions to you are, firstly, who is Jessica Zitter?
Jessica Zitter is a doctor who loves to save life, but also loves for people to have the life that they want all the way until the end, which may not be on machines.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I want to empower people to make sure that they stay in the driver's seat of their own lives all the way until they die, that they are always in control, that their preferences and values are always at the top of the list of considerations.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose seems to have become to be an advocate for this cause, which is to really enhance communication and help to empower our entire society to live the way they want all the way until the end.
Jessica Zitter, MD, thank you so much for joining us on the program. Normally, I have a conversation with my guests for an hour plus. But when they offered me the half hour, I said, this is too important to let go. So I decided to go ahead and do this portion of the program with you. And I thank you so much for your time. And I'm hoping that we might be able to continue this conversation, A, through your publicist, or B, if you ever find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we would love to have you in studio.
I would absolutely love it and jump at the chance. And if you would like to get back in touch with my publicist, please do, and I will come down and meet you anytime.
I will do it. And also, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, the best way is to go to my website, which is jessicazitter.com, and there's a contact button there, and I'm looking forward to hearing from people, and I really would be thrilled to hear from people.
jessicazitter.com is the website, and Jessica, again, thank you so much for joining us on Tell Me Your Story. It's been a great pleasure.
Great pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
And we are clear. Thank you so much. This was fantastic. And as I say, I wish we had had more time, but I know you've got other interviews that are coming up.
Oh, I'd love to come down sometime. So keep in touch. You'll call Penguin and let them know that you'd like to talk with me again.
Yeah, I'll get a hold of Terry at Playback Producer. Call the number here. Also, I wanted to get you a copy of this interview. I can get you this or wait until I produce the full program.
That would be terrific. I can wait until you produce the full program. Do you have my email?
I do not. No. What is it?
Let me give it to you. It's Zitter, J N as in Nancy. So Z I T T E R J N as in Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
At Gmail.
At Gmail. Great. Gmail. And I know it's the top of the hour, so I know you've got another interview. Thank you again, and many blessings to you. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye bye.
Your stories, I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We come your way Sundays at 1 a.m. I take that back. That's Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., 1 a.m. on Monday mornings, and also archived at richarddugan.com. We stream live there as well, richarddugan.com. And we archive these programs at, gee, I wonder if it could be richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. Why, by golly, you betcha. And that's where you'll find not only the link to the interview, but you'll also find links to our guests' websites to get more information. And we'll give you the website to our guest today in just a few moments. I want to let you know that this particular program is sort of a second half, if you will, of a two-part program that I think is extremely important. I realize that this subject of transitioning is very difficult for a lot of folks, and I get that. At the same time, we have, and this is just my perception, my guest may or may not agree, and that's fine. We'll find out where she stands in a moment. We need some serious re-educating about this process, about what it means to live a life of quality as opposed to quantity. And I know I've jokingly said about my great-grandmother, who was 95 at the time I started saying this, that I was going to outlive her, but she was making it really hard. And she passed away at the age of 100. So I've got a long way to go. I've already celebrated my 57th birthday. I'm now working on year 58, and I've got a good 42 years to go to at least match her longevity. That is assuming that I am at a place of good health, of mobility, quality of life, enjoying what I'm doing, and I'm hoping this is what I'm doing 42 years from now. That would be kind of exciting for me. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that, but we're also going to talk from the perspective more so of folks who find themselves at the end of their rope. They see no other alternative, but basically to, I'm not sure, certainly the word suicide is used. I was going to say self-transitioning. I suppose there are other creative words we could come up with, but basically saying, look, I just don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to deal with this. And we're going to talk about that in regards to a work that she's put out. Her name is Adele Paula Royce, The Little Black Book of Suicide Notes. And Adele, thank you so much for joining the program. We're going to do everything we can to keep this as uplifting as possible.
Well, thanks so much, Richard, for having me and allowing me to bring this message of hope out into the world.
I was not a part or a member of, but I was connected with through a radio station I was working for at the time. Ironically, it was a Christian radio station, with an organization in Phoenix called Suiciders Anonymous.
Interesting to me.
Yeah, and it worked just like every other 12-step program. And any time that you felt you were going down that path, you would call your sponsor, if you will, and they would, hopefully metaphorically and not literally, talk you off the ledge. And yet at the same time, I remember in one of my interviews many years ago with a gal who was about fun and about enjoying life, and she was a caregiver for a 94-year-old woman who was perfectly sane. She was perfectly healthy, having a great time up to a certain stage, and then she came to this friend of mine and said, you know what? There's nothing more I want to do. I'm done. I she wasn't depressed. She wasn't terminal. It's kind of like, I don't like this car. I want to trade it in on a newer model. And my friend supposedly assisted in that process.
Right.
And this is many years ago. And I thought, wow. I mean, first of all, to be a part of something like that. And we know about Dr. Jack Kevorkian many years ago. I think he's since passed, has he not?
Yes, he is deceased, and it's actually in note number 27 of the 27 suicide notes, which are actually, you know, the novel is comprised of 27 suicide notes, but they're written by a woman on a spiritual journey. This is basically a book, a first part of a planned trilogy of life, death, and rebirth. And basically, Dr. Kevorkian and I had mentioned in note number 27. Mm-hmm. And once again, just to reframe this for you and your audience, you know, this is a book of hope. And going from a life, death, rebirth, the darkness to light situation, showing people there is a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, they aren't suicide notes left behind per se. They're a series of reflections, journal entries of a sort, you know, that chart her emotional and spiritual journey as she confronts the question that you were just proposing, you know, whether life is or is not worth living, you know, and it gives an intimate look into the experience of hopelessness through the journey, and it highlights her desire to find a way out. And that's a very interesting concept from my observation. So, you know, when you speak about people that are at the end of their rope, you know, you often wonder what brings someone to the end of their rope. You know, a lot of people believe that the purpose of living is to get to a non-disturbed state. Well, guess what? It's not. It's fun if you can get there, but that's not the purpose. You know, you're coming into this with an inherent, you know, essence of suffering. You know, I wanted to share this story with the world to let people know, you know, who are suffering, that there's still hope, that they're not alone. Just as you said, it's a kindred spirit reaching out to someone on the ledge to let someone know. And I say this from experience. I've done a lot of homework on this. The demographics are jaw-dropping. I mean, children of 10 to 13, 13 to 15. I just heard of an incident the other day on local news, and it just blew my own mind to hear something like this. You know, sometimes you think that people in later life experience, you know, a lot of trauma, and maybe they feel that there's no other reason for them to be here. You know, and they choose, you know, we do have free will to go another route. You know, but when you're looking at an epidemic proportion in the society, it really does need to be addressed. And interestingly enough, you know, and I don't want you or your audience to take this the wrong way, but after years of spiritual searching, and I've had many years of conventional, you know, therapeutics, mm-hmm. which bring you to kind of a balanced state to maybe get to the next level, and my next level was a spiritual one. So I decided to delve into this on a more spiritual and moral dimension, you know, and I had a realization, and I think you might find this interesting. I had a realization that there really is no cure for suffering. You know, I felt I needed to tell it in a way that would kind of take the pressure off of people to go around finding a solution to something that really doesn't exist. I mean, now how can you say something like that? I'll tell you how. I mean, through the story of this protagonist, you follow her through the process of realizing that suffering is inherent to existence. And how she comes to terms with it, you know, it's kind of paradoxical. But the key insight is that although human suffering is innate, there is a light at the end of that tunnel. And, you know, I'll just briefly go into something that I think might be a good, you know, start off point for this, because I'm sure you have a lot to contribute and things you want to hear from me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just to say that the suicidal tendency is based on a feeling of hopelessness. And that's not a pretty feeling to experience, you know, the feeling that you're not able to experience anything beyond that feeling. You know, and it's been my experience, you know, once you realize kind of how this game of life is played, so to speak, you know, and that might take a little guidance or maybe a teacher or a therapist or there, you know, it's a very complex issue. There are so many different dimensions involved here that you then can begin to have a handle on how to relate to all of this and make peace with that truth.
Well, you know, I have to say that I have not, that I can recall, ever experienced those sensations. But, you know, I when you made the comment that there is no cure for suffering, and I say this somewhat facetiously, I beg to differ. I've seen the commercials on TV from all the pharmaceutical companies. Although the side effects for the cure, and actually it's not a cure, it's a treatment.
One was suicide.
Is one is suicide.
Yes.
I still love the one for a heart condition. And it ran through the long laundry list, and it was a long, must have been a 2-minute commercial. And believe it or not, I seriously had to laugh when I heard this.
Yeah.
One of the side effects was the condition you were taking the medication for.
That's exactly right.
There's a quote that you have, actually many quotes throughout this book, and one of them in particular, it touches my heart because of the fact that it takes me back many years. And this is, I'm going to read this quote very quickly. "The sword of time will pierce our skin. It doesn't hurt when it begins, but as we work it, as it works its way in, the pain grows stronger. Watch it grin. Suicide is painless. It brings on many changes, and I can take or leave it if I please." And if those of you who are familiar and older, you'll remember that is the vocals to the lyrics to the theme song from the series MASH. And if you think there was a situation, as I watched that series, where you didn't want to check out almost through almost every episode because it was so depressing because of what was going on, and we look at our lives today, I mean, I have to tell you that I don't think I'm mistaken in this, but shortly after the either the election or the inauguration, there was a spike in the suicide rate. Now, there's no conclusive evidence as to the cause, as to the reason, but it was certainly, and I don't believe in coincidence, I believe in coincidence.
Agree.
I don't believe in coincidence. These took place for a very significant reason, but I think it's fallen on deaf ears. When I did hear this, I don't know that many other people heard that. And it's very sad that people seem to think that other people's activities in the world are that important that they need to do this. But hey, you know, I don't know the psychology of it all.
Well, you know, it's even more than psychology, from my opinion, you know, observation. I mean, when you look at this, man is not a machine. You know, you talk about the medical institutions. I mean, there are 5 basic institutions, your educational systems. I mean, people are conditioned in many different ways, if you will. I mean, man is not a machine. It's a very complex organism. You know, it's a universal organism. You know, it's almost, I had a conversation with someone yesterday on a very ethereal ground. You know, basically, you're living in a universe that's living through you and you're living through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all part of one. And yet, we have become so conditioned to the forces that be, that it really takes fighting your way out of a paper bag at times to really understand how to adjust yourself to a sane and sober, so to speak, life, and how to live a simpler way. You know, many of us live in what I call to be a false state of emergency, and I'll explain that. You know, a false state of emergency, Richard, is an emergency. You're reacting to something that feels real, but it's not in essence true, okay? My teacher would always give 2 great examples, you know, and he'd make a wonderful point. One true state of emergency could be, say, if someone were pointing a gun to your head, okay, ready to pull that trigger. Another might be if a grizzly bear were coming toward you and ready to attack. Now, those are true emergencies. However, when one is full of fear, anxiety, depression, any of those false selves, those inner terrorists, those disturbed states, they might be feeling, okay, that sensation, but they're not really under any kind of real threat. You know, they might be experiencing this, but it's not true. So through this protagonist story, you can learn that you don't have to live this way. And I had, you know, a part of the book that states, you know, learning how to, you need to learn how not to live in order to learn how to live, so to speak. Mm. Okay? And knowing that you don't have to live this way is a very productive thing to have in your bailiwick of tools to learn how to live this life in a profitable way, you know, in a productive way, in a fun way, in a beautiful way, how it was meant to be lived. It is a gift. It's just, you know, sometimes people have a lot of problems, you know, really opening that kind of ribbon and finding what's inside of that box, you know. And that realization, once you find it, can really result in, as I say, living a much more, you know, balanced, sane, and simpler kind of a life and understanding what you're doing here, you know.
Yeah, and at the same time, there are people who, I mean, we have them on the program on a regular basis who talk about just doing that, of doing just that, of living a simpler life. I mean, there are people who are working to get off the grid. They aren't guests that we've had on this program because they're off the grid. We can't get hold of them. But we, you know, I mean, I happen to be very fortunate that I live above Santa Barbara in the mountains. At the summit of the San Ynez Mountains, going over into the valley,
and we have,
you know, we live on a 10-acre property where we occupy probably an acre and a half. We have all indoor cats, six of them. We have two dogs. We are in the process of reintegrating chickens back into our lifestyle, which we had at one time. We've had deer on the property, which I've seen recently. We've had a bear. I've got some pictures of. As a matter of fact, I had a close encounter with the bear twice. We've had bobcats, I'm sure, and so forth and so on. And so we've had the privilege, and I say privilege, of being able to be around the creatures of the wild, if you will. Non-interference, I must tell you, non-interference. We do not... We observe. That's it. That's all we do. And
yes,
it is a calming effect. And yet there are those who live in, you're in New York City, right?
Well, I was just going to bring that up. It's a very viable point. You know, city mouse, country mouse.
Yeah.
Welcome to the world. I live in a city of 8 million, 3 million right on this rock.
Sure. But you know? Have a park that is sort of kind of nature centered, if you will, sort of kind of, but you're surrounded by, I'm sure you, even if you were and I've only been there once in 1993, and believe it or not, I was there on Earth Day and I saw 1.5 million people heading towards us toward that big old brown fountain.
Right.
And we hightailed it out of there because I did not want to get mixed up in that. But,
you
have the city around you, and I mean, you've got, at least it's something, but still, people find it very difficult to find that place where they can get centered and get calm and say, you know what, my troubles aren't that important. Not comparing them to someone else's and going, well, boy, theirs are much worse than mine, so I shouldn't really be worried about it. It's my problems in the grand scheme of things aren't nothing. I mean, and I say this seriously. I've been around for 57 years. That's less than a puff of smoke.
Yes.
In the
yes.
eternity of yes. the universe.
It really is. You know, but you're talking about something very interesting. You're talking about, you know, it's all an inside job. In other words, it's looking at something and observing. I mean, if you take yourself and let's say, you know, you view yourself as an alien ship above, say on a 30,000-foot level, if I can just give you a graphic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, someone's coming down on that spaceship and observing you. Well, if you be that observer, okay, if you can become that observer, you automatically are disconnected from all of the full states that your mind does play tricks on you. You know, I mean, the brain is a creative and wonderful tool, but the mind, you know, is another entity. I mean, that mind plays tricks on us, and sometimes those tricks are deadly. And if you don't know how to separate yourself from the falsehoods of what it might be telling you, then, you know, you're in for a ride. I mean, you know, again, this is a very complex issue, but I have to tell you something. If you look at, you know, it could be mental illness, brain chemistry, family life, social structure, you know, and many more things. You know, I'm sure if you looked at the pharmaceutical companies, they would come up with many more things as well, mm-hmm. to take more drugs, okay? That, in my opinion, is not the solution, because, you know, I know people who have been taking drugs for 50 years, okay, so to speak, and, you know, nothing's changed. So, you know, what I wanted to explore, like I said before, was to delve into it on more of a spiritual and moral dimension, mm-hmm. you know, because suicide fundamentally, because it's a state of hopelessness, it's all about one's internal freedom. You're kind of going from a state of, you know, you're journeying through enslavement to freedom, and that's what this story is about.
Well, and you by look the at way, someone, you mentioned yes? drugs. Another quote, dreams. Aberrations, illuminations, religions, the whole, I have to be careful here, the whole boatload of sensitive BS, Allen Ginsberg.
Yes, another point in time, but it was very poignantly stated. And if you do take someone like, say, Dr. Viktor Frankl, who lived in the concentration camps, you know, he explained in his writings that the only thing that his captors could not take away from him was his internal freedom. You know, and that freedom is not something, getting back to the medical industry, that can be surgically removed. So this book is about finding one's own path to one's own internal freedom. And, you know, somehow there's an element of craziness or insanity. There's a stigmatism about the suicidal tendency. Now you have bullying coming into the picture. I mean, you know, it's technology. You know, I say there are things that can cure you as well as kill you. You know, the technology is phenomenal. I mean, look what we're doing now. We're speaking to one another. You're, you know, in California. I'm in New York. How wonderful is that? You can pick up a cell phone and speak with someone or text someone in real time over in, you know, Bangladesh. But basically, the speed and the rate at which all of this is happening in this society at this point in time, for some reason, we may never know why. You know, you're almost living in that matrix. You know, you take one pill to stay there. You take one pill if you really have the courage to want to know the truth. Mm-hmm. But the stigmatism of the craziness and insanity about it, you know, I mean, some of the brightest minds of our times committed suicide. And, you know, people think there's something wrong with them. Well, guess what? This book is trying to show people that that is not the case.
Okay. And that's a big issue in that respect, because our feelings and emotions are, they are part of, they aren't us, but they are part of what makes us who we are. And it would be like denying that you have a left arm. Assuming yeah. that you have a left arm, not wanting to be disrespectful to anybody here.
Right.
But it's extremely important to start looking at that. It's like I was watching this is interesting because I do want to get into these two aspects that you've delved into here.
Sure.
Watch the movie A Dog's Purpose the other day. And watched as this dog goes through lifetime after lifetime after lifetime and trying to find out what his purpose is. And he, at the end of it all, found it. He figured out what it was. But we seem to forget when we come into this world. And again, this is assuming you believe in reincarnation. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's a struggle for us to find our purpose. It's one of the three questions that I put to my guests at the end of the program, and there are those who seem to think they know how we can find it, so we seek them out. There are people that we will follow for our entire lifetimes, and believe it or not, I'm one of the few, I'm sure, who hasn't found anyone. There are some significant people that I've had in my life, but there's no one quote-unquote guru that I say, oh, yeah, I follow the words that this guy has said or that book has said or what have you. I'm trying to glean from you, Adele, and everybody else to try to make sense of it all.
Well, you know, some of the sense I can make is, you know, Richard, let me put it to you this way, okay? You can study this from the North, from the South, from the Eastern cultures, from the Western cultures. You know, all roads lead to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them is going to come back to the same point. You know, the past is dead, buried, gone. There is no future. You're just making up stories of things that actually don't exist. And if you take that to the nth degree, maybe you're even going into a psychotic, a schizophrenic state. Okay, so basically where are you left? You're left to stay in the moment. And that's a very tough thing to do. And it's evidenced by the epidemic proportions of suicide at this point in time that most people have not nailed how to do that. It's a very difficult chore. And people do look outside of themselves for this, for some guidance. They do go to people, and they go to groups, and they try therapy, and they try, you know, spiritual practices. And yes, everything in a holistic way might have some sort of an impact. But the bottom line is it's an inside job. And you need to start delving inward. You need to start delving inward and inward and inward. You know, interestingly enough, the meditation, you know, what is meditation? I mean, there is no East or West. It's basically just different facets of how you do it. I mean, it's what is the difference between East and West when you're sitting, you know, say in a chair or, you know, in a room, you're breathing, you're listening to your breath. Does that have any significance whether you're from the East or the West? You're listening to your breath and you're following your breath and you try to get yourself into a centered state, you know, where the conscious and the subconscious kind of start coming and melding together and you start burning out some of these issues that might have been, you know, affecting you in a non-productive way. But the idea is that that can take you to just a certain point. You know, you cannot rely on the outside institutions. You cannot rely, in my opinion, in the medical institutions, in the educational institutions. You know, they say the best form of education, someone told me, was homeschooling. You know, I mean, there are so many different aspects and ways you can look at this. You know, you had said that you are not the type of a person that had experienced these types of feelings. You're one of the very fortunate ones, you know. I mean, if you look at the stadiums, if you look at, I'm talking now, say, religion or theology, okay, I mean, they're filling up stadiums with hundreds of thousands of people. You look at speakers such as, you know, say, an Eckhart Tolle, who have beautiful things to say, and he does beautiful work. You know, people from all over the world are following these people, so there must be something to the idea and the sensations that people are basically trying to find something to have some sort of relief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, relief from what? I was speaking to someone the other day, you know, a PhD from Vassar College, and it's a friend of mine. And basically, you know, he said, well, you know, how can you not have fear? You know, you come here, you don't know where you came from. You know you're going to die, you don't know where you're going, you know, and then you're left with this in between. You know, it's like, so how can you kind of try to make some sense out of that? And yet we all try to make some sense out of this. You know, I mean, it was Camus. I'm a very fond proponent of Camus, and if your audience isn't familiar, I'll just brush through it. You know, Albert Camus was a French philosopher and a writer, and I quoted what I thought was a very significant piece of his work from The Myth of Sisyphus, and it was nailing a very essential philosophical question, and it was, you know, is life worth living or is it not worth living? You know, I mean, in terms of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And it was based on this Greek mythological figure. Say that three times fast. And he's pushing a boulder up and up and up over this hill. And every time he gets to the top, the boulder comes crashing back down on him. You know, so I believe that our job in this life is to keep moving forward. You know, step by step, take some action, maybe one fine day with enough courage, that boulder might stay at the top and just remain there. But, you know, it's only then that one can really answer for themselves the fundamental question that Camus actually proposed, because you've experienced it for yourself. You know, when a person begins to journey inside of themselves, they might be very pleasantly surprised to see what they find. And I just wanted to say one more thing, because I hear you wanted to say something. But basically, someone had, you know, spoken with me and told me that they looked at the title of the book and they wrote a comment on Amazon. You know, they ask if you want to write a comment of the book. And the comment was that they were not going to read it because they had an aversion to the subject matter and they were afraid. They were literally afraid to tap into it. But they thought, I'll throw caution to the wind and I'll check it out. And they were very glad they did. So when a person begins to journey inside of themselves and maybe find something very, you know, some gold, that's what this book is about. You're journeying inside this little book that might not appear so, you know, fresh and beautiful and lovely at first, you know, but there is gold inside of it. And it's an interesting read and an interesting path, and I really truly hope in a very humble way that it's a humble gesture for people to, you know, make them feel better.
Well, you know, people have to seek out and find those things that work for them. There's no question about it.
And there's a
poem that I found out about in the 90s going through a personal growth and development program back in Phoenix. And I believe the author's name, I may be wrong with this. I want to give due credit and all, and I'm going to be paraphrasing anyway, but it's okay. I believe it was a gentleman by the name of Sebastian. I think that was the last name. Anyway, the poem, the gist of it is that the gods, they're a little concerned about man and his trying to find the answers and seek out ways to be like God. I mean, they were all really freaked out, and so they all got together in this conclave, and they said, "Okay, well, let's take the truth. Let's hide it here in the mountains. No, he'll find a way to climb it. Let's in the depths of the oceans. No, he'll find a way to get down there and find it. And one place after another." On the moon and this and that and the other. And finally one said, "I know, let's hide it in his heart. He'll never look there."
Yes, and that's something that needs to be open. The heart needs to be open to express itself. You know, sometimes the heart is a little bit more closed than we want it to be. And, you know, it takes some work and it takes some strength to, you know, slowly chip away, to open it, to see how beautiful, you know, this life really can be. And, you know, it's interesting, but it's a fact of life. Look, I mean, everything has an opposite. You wouldn't know hot if you didn't know cold. You wouldn't know up if you didn't know down. I mean, I can go on forever. You wouldn't know good if you didn't know evil. Well, you wouldn't know light if you didn't know dark. And again, there are people, you know, I always say this with my friends, you know, there are a few people that are touched, you know, by the hand of, if you will, God or source or, you know, universe, whatever you want to term it, you know, the terminology you might feel comfortable using, you know. But basically, if you do have these feelings, you know, there is a way out. And I think it's really important. And I think, you know, there's a value in everything. There's even a value in darkness. You know, it's showing you that you're out of balance in some which way, shape, and manner. And that might be the catalyst to start one on their journey. You know, I mean, the suicide rates are, as I say, in epidemic proportion. So basically, you're looking at something, it's an issue. I mean, the combat deaths, I wrote it in the book, you know, are exceeding, you know, the suicide rate is exceeding the combat rate in the military. I mean, that's mind-blowing, you know. And again, I say the demographics are mind-blowing. What would cause a 13-year-old child to take their own lives, to go into a room and, you know, do themselves in? I mean, we're looking for ways to try to recondition the society, and it took a long time to get us here, but I believe there are so many levels of consciousness that is starting to raise and raise and raise, you know, the same way you're alluding to, I don't want to get into a political talk here, but with the election, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I think that people are starting to have more of a voice. The people are starting to not be held down, so to speak, you know, and take, you know, take it a gratis that what people are telling them are true. You know, I think one needs to find their own truth. And it was so well stated. One of my very favorite films, I don't know if you saw it, was Into the Wild. I think Sean Penn directed it with Emile Hirsch was the actor. But he said, you know, and I watch it from time to time just for inspiration, and it was kind of a rites of passage, you know, film. And the flick was just wonderful. And the protagonist was saying, you know, I don't want money. I don't want love. I don't want fortune. I don't want fame. I want truth. Because the truth is what's in front of you. It's not a made-up story of what you think things are, what you think things were, what you think things might be, but it's one of the saints said it, face what's in front of you and the rest will be revealed. If you can just stay focused in that moment, which again, is not an easy thing to do, but it's a challenge, you know, you might look at it as a kind of like a diet, you know, it's like a challenge. You know? Let me see how long I can stay in the moment, in this moment, and maybe go into the next moment. And, you know, then the feelings do start to dissipate. So, you know, as I started writing, I decided to take it further and further. And this is book one of the trilogy. The second part is actually going to be taking the audience on a journey through death and actually talking in novel form, of course, you know, to all of the people, the famous philosophers, the Hemingways, the Van Goghs, the Gauguin, the 27 Club, all of the people who had life in the palm of their hand, okay, mm-hmm. and yet did themselves in. You know, and going to be interviewing them, so to speak, and find out what they have to say for themselves. And the third and final book of the trilogy is entitled, you know, Coming Back to Life, Coming Back to This Mortal Coil. And it's going to be finding what this life is all about, which is a subtitle to the Little Black Book of Suicide Notes. It's coming back to life in a new way. So I'm hoping that it'll be very productive for people that are searching, and it might be another tool for them to grasp onto.
Well, I know that for many folks, the subject is there's no question it's taboo, but we're talking about it more and more. There are subjects we're talking about more and more now that we never wanted to deal with. And I'm sure that as you have gone through your own personal growth and process on a metaphysical or spiritual level, acknowledging the interconnectedness we share with one another.
Yeah.
You can't separate. It is impossible, you know, as no matter how hard you try, I don't care who you are and what you've done, it is impossible to separate us from one another. And I this is the analogy that I've used, God, 40-some-odd years? Almost. If God, the universal power, had intended for each one of us 7.5, nearly 8 billion people to live solitary single lives, there are certainly sufficient, M-class planets for each one of us to live on. However, the reality is, there are 7.5 to 8 billion people on this planet, and that tells
right.
me that we are supposed to work together.
Yes.
And yeah. Not work at trying to annihilate ourselves, or each other, for that matter. And so when I step into these programs and I start talking with people such as yourself, we're trying to find ways of breaking through. And I'm going to say the lack of understanding or the unwillingness
yes.
to understand that we are all connected. And it's very interesting. There's very little conversation going on about some of the things that are happening globally that are affecting everyone on the planet. One in particular is the pollution that's being generated, although they are working on trying to curtail that a little. In China, that's coming across. It's dropping into the Pacific Ocean. It's coming onto the shores of the West Coast, not just of Northern America, North America, but Central and South America. The power plant that was overrun by this tsunami several years ago, the radiation, it's in the Pacific Ocean as well, and it is moving eastward. These are just two prime examples of how actions by others are affecting us. My wife does not want me to eat any seafood if it's coming out of the waters of the West Coast.
Yeah.
And then
I'm thinking,
well, what about the East Coast? I mean, you know, is it any better? And I love ahi tuna, you know, I'm sorry to say. But the reality is that here we are. We're here together. We need to find ways, find common ground. And at the same time, Adele, I'm curious, and I want to talk about this when we get back, about this whole aspect. The example that I gave earlier of someone who just basically says, you know what? I'm done. I've done all I want to do. I've accomplished everything that I set out to accomplish. My bucket list is done. I've checked everything off. I'm ready to go. Why can't I go? You'll let me take on any job I want, take on any religion I want, eat any food I want, create any family I want, but you won't let me leave?
Well, I'll tell you something very interesting about that on the return.
All right. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. New Paradigms for a New World. We are talking with the author of the first of three books, The Little Black Book of Suicide Notes, and her name is Adele Polaroisen. We're going to give you her email address here in just a couple of minutes when we get back from break. We encourage you to stay tuned. I think that this is an important conversation to have, regardless of where you stand spectrumly, if you will, in regards to this whole aspect of suicide. And we'll do that in just as soon as we get back from this break. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. New paradigms for a new world.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Thank you so much for staying with us as we continue our conversation with Adele Polaroisen and her little book. Not that thick. You probably could do it in an evening's read if you so desire, although I would take each chapter and ponder it, each note, if you will, from the Little Black Book of Suicide Notes. And Adele, what would be the best way for people? I know I'm sure it's available on Amazon and so on and so forth, but website, where would be the best place for folks to touch base with you as well as look into this work and the other two in this trilogy?
Sure. It's AdelePolaroisen.com. It's my name. And they could purchase it via Amazon through the website or Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And there's a wonderful, also for any of those music aficionados out there, a wonderful audiobook version from Audible and iTunes that actually I had obtained the recording rights for a wonderful, talented artist to record Suicide is Painless from MASH, a fellow by the name of Tony Noe. And that's actually in the audiobook. And I do the performance, the spoken word, because as Bob Dylan, who's one of my favorite, industry music, I'm one of his biggest fans, he basically said, you know, he wanted his music sung, you know, because he knew how he wanted to have it heard.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to have these notes read a certain way. I wanted to express them in my own voice,
mm-hmm.
and I read them. So it's quite interesting, and Dr. Gerald Epstein, who wrote the foreword to this book, who's actually my teacher, he is a spiritual teacher and a psychoanalyst back in 1974, switched gears when he met his teacher and went through this whole change in the way to treat the human condition of body, mind, and spirit, and a different form of medical, you know, conditioning for people. And he wrote the foreword, and he also speaks the foreword in the audiobook, so that's available as well. So it's AdelePolaroisen.com, and I have a wonderful Facebook page under the same name, and I've been conversing with many people. It's getting a wonderful response. There are so many people looking to, you know, find some answers to a question, you know, that you had actually asked before the break. And you were asking, you know, about a person, well, say they come to the end of their rope, you know, well, should they be allowed? Can they do it? How do they do it? Why would they do it? And all of those questions come up. You know, if you're talking about a couple of different issues here that are really interesting to go into, I mean, if you held your hand in the sake of energy under a high-powered microscope, you would not see solid matter, all right? You'd see wavicles and particles. So just by mere virtue of that alone, Richard, we are one. It's one big energetic field, okay? There is no separation.
Mm-hmm.
If you stare into space, sometimes you can even see it. Sometimes I'm looking at a rug and I can see it waving, you know. It's like it's energy, you know. In a yoga class, sometimes you can feel it moving through you. It's an energetic field. But we are all one. But we are bought with free will, you know. And I have to tell you an interesting story to me that I had someone proofread this book who is very, very highly intelligent and had some legal counsel. And in one of the notes, I had stated that you do not have a legal right to tell me any different, meaning to go through with this act. And the gentleman told me to take out the word legal, all right? And I said, no, I don't think that I want to do that. And he said, it's not legal in certain states. And I did my own research because I didn't take it for gratis. And I actually found out, you know, through reading, that that's why people are afraid to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not legal if you wanted to follow through with the act in certain areas. And to me, you know, that's something that is actually interfering with your God-given free will or your source-given free will. I use the term God because I use the term God. You know, to me it's refreshing, but to other people, you know, they might come from it at a different angle. So you are born with free will, and that gives you choice. You know, they said it in the Bible. I mean, you were talking about Christianity before in some, you know, classes that you had attended.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Deuteronomy 30:19, they said that every moment God sets before you, you know, good, evil, life, death, choose life, and you and your descendants will live. Well, just take it that to the nth degree. If you keep choosing life in that moment-to-moment state, life, 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 you might even live into eternity. I mean, there might be no death. You know, you might just sail right through it. It's a very interesting, open universe with so many, a plethora of possibilities that once a person is able, and again, I say able to, because when you're in these types of, you know, full states of emergency, sometimes you're not really able at that point in time to see the larger picture. But once you're able to kind of push through that and persevere through that, you know, like the Nike slogan, just do it, you know, take some action. Magical things start to happen, you know, when you work on inspiration and miraculous things start to open up. So, you know, you can really start to write your very own scroll in this life and not just deal with the one you've been given, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting that you should bring that up because I'm having conversations with people left and right, both within the context of these interviews as well as just my day-to-day interactions with people. And one gentleman is sharing with me, he says, oh, the script's already written, you know? You're just following the script.
Right.
You know, and it's you know, and I'm because years ago, even while I was working for a Christian radio station slowly but surely working my way through a lot of the theology and the doctrine and dogma and sloughing it off as being illogical, I came to a point where I had to either take the position that my life had meaning and that I had a purpose in this life. And so I wasn't going to spend it raping, pillaging, and plundering the countryside.
Right.
Or my life had no meaning, and I could do just that. I could rape, pillage, and plunder, and it wouldn't matter. Wouldn't matter because my life has no meaning. It doesn't matter. And you know, and there are moments in my scant little, tiny little 57 years of existence where I have felt a little bit like, you know, it doesn't really matter. I mean, look at what's going on around me, and the this and that and the other. But I stay the course as best I can. And try to, you know, follow the rules, as it were, and read what I should read, and do what I should do, and follow the precepts that my parents tried to set down and lay before me as far as being a good citizen and just a good person in general, and how to treat other people as well as myself.
Right. And I have an interesting comment to make about that I bet will resonate well with you.
And it's you know, and so to pass this on to someone who is in that place, that darkness.
Yes.
And try to convince them. And that's where the struggle comes. And I, when dealing with these people that I dealt with through the Suiciders Anonymous group back in Phoenix, God, some 20, 30 years ago, and I was shocked because that an organization like this even existed, you know, and not to be flippant, but I mean, the membership's got to be dwindling if people are unfortunately successful. And again, that's a judgment too. That's the other aspect of all of this is, you know, when you're talking about the spiritual aspects, the ramifications in that regard, it's like, well, wait a minute, but either we have free will or we don't. And these people have free will. And regardless of their state or frame of mind, they still have free will in that frame of mind.
Yes, yes. And, you know, it's a bit of a spark of homeopathy. As you were saying, you know, you happen to be a very upbeat and positive individual, and that's so refreshing. And your spark, this book is based on homeopathy. Like I said, most great poetry can express that. You know, sometimes you hate to say it, but, you know, misery might like company, you know. But when you look at it from the other aspect, it's a homeopathic, it's like taking drops. One time I found out I was allergic to bananas or dairy or something. I mean, and what's the, you know, the doctor, the homeopathist had said was to give me this tincture of what the actual substance was made out of. And you take it slowly, you know, sublingually, and you take it for a period of time until your body adjusts to it and you're no longer affected by that substance. So your allergy starts to dissipate. You know, you are able to enjoy those foods. I mean, if you take that on the other end of the spectrum, I mean, homeopathically, you look at something like 9/11. I mean, that, I mean, tragedy doesn't even express the words, mm-hmm. but that was a homeopathic type of incidence. I mean, you had 19 people, as you said, we're living in a world of 7 billion to 8 billion souls. You had 19 people, I believe, with primitive weapons, box cutters, I believe they were, you know, and they changed the course of the world. Now, I mean, that is basically a homeopathic. That was a little affecting a lot,
mm-hmm.
you know. So as you can do it, like I said, the technology can kill you. The technology can cure you, in my opinion. You know, someone like yourself, someone like myself, having a spark of light into an otherwise dark and dismal corner, as I said, of this existence. You never really know who that's affecting because it can affect so many. That little spark can start radiating out your contribution, your harmless contribution to humanity, and hopefully mine as well, and many others, can start to change the situation and make this, as the movie said, a beautiful life.
Yeah. Two things. A movie that I watched and I've seen, I think I may have watched it twice because it was so interesting, was the fact, was the movie, I think it was entitled Looking for a Friend for the End of the World.
Oh, Wow. And, I haven't seen it.
Oh, it basically, there is a meteor heading for the Earth. And it is an extinction event. And so they focus on this one guy and the last, I don't know, few weeks, if you will, in his life, as he searches for someone to spend the final days. He has a cathartic experience with his estranged father, who wanted to go back and rehash everything and apologize. And he says, no, that is not why I am here. I am here now to relate with you, and so on and so forth. But you mentioned about 9/11, and I don't know what the number was, of people who chose to leave that building out the window.
Yes.
They knew there was little hope of their survival, so they basically chose their end. And it wasn't, that was not, I don't know whether I can even, that wasn't suicide. Not in the classic sense as we're talking here.
I understand where you're coming from.
They had free will. They could have stayed right where they were with those people, but they chose a different option.
Right. They chose a different option. I mean, you know, I knew someone who had actually run down the stairs from, I think, the 90-something floor. They were able to come down the staircase. But the bottom line is maybe they were able to do that. You know, that's a situation that's that we'll really never know. But unfortunately, it happened, and, you know, hopefully we'll never see the likes of it again.
Sure, but we have incidents that happen on a smaller scale around the world where, you know, and it isn't necessarily in a suicide bomber, someone in a truck. Sometimes it's just accident, natural occurrence, natural disasters, too much rainfall and we get a mudslide, or there's an earthquake, or here in Southern California, Central California, we have the wildfires, you know, that could sweep through and you know, hopefully you get out of the way in time. I have to say that I've lived here for 11 years and the first couple of years were great, but the next six, I was actually questioning what my own personal sanity. Why the hell did I move from Phoenix, Arizona, where it's hotter than blazes under the sun, to a place where it's hotter than blazes, and I don't know whether I will survive or my belongings or my loved ones will survive?
Right.
You know, I'm going, but then I realized, you know, it doesn't matter where you live, you're going to deal with these kinds of threats, if you will.
Well, it's like Viktor Frankl, you know, it's your reaction to the situation.
Yeah.
It's how do you react? How is your adaptation to a situation?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that goes back to the medical community, you know, and I'm not going to start World War III right now, but I mean, if you look at cancer, you know, is there cancer? I mean, if they wanted to cure it, I mean, you know, maybe they could just do that, you know? I mean, I find it hard-pressed to believe that there is no cure for cancer at this point in time, you know, but just think of the antithesis of that, you know, of what other, you know, portions of this existence would be affected by that, you know. So you need to kind of be a renegade with something like this. You know, the doctor that wrote the foreword, you know, you need to be a bit of a renegade for something like this. You need to really have a passion and believe in what you're saying and face the truth and, you know, take the consequences as they come up.
Yeah.
And it's not an easy route to go.
Oh, no.
But I have to tell you something. It's a rewarding group, because if one life can be saved, one life that's dangling off that cliff, then I would have done my job.
Well, I have to say, too, that in my 15 years at that religious radio station, I was asking the kinds of questions that would have been, I would have a big giant H branded on my forehead today for being a heretic, and would have worn it proudly, because doggone it, I was just so tired of being told what I was supposed to and not supposed to do and think and believe and say and be. And it didn't make any logical sense that, as I said earlier in the program, that I can eat any food I want. I can go and get pretty much any education that I want. I can travel pretty much anywhere I want, drink whatever I want, have whatever associations I want. But there's only one spiritual path. That doesn't make any sense.
No.
And so, you know, asking the hard questions and talking about them, these subjects, is extremely important. And we try to do it in as respectful and as considerate way as we can. But the fact of the matter is that this is what's going on in our world. And there are people who do reach a point because of whatever their conditions, psychological or physical, mental, emotional, or physical, where they want out. They want to, and again, this goes back to the issue of whether or not you believe that there is an afterlife or a life after this one, reincarnation. They want to start over. This has just become horrendous.
Yeah, you know, different religions, again, it's a religious thing, a theological thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, however you want to view it, spiritual thing. But, you know, as I say, all roads lead to Rome. The idea is to really try to stay in that moment and live it well, as my teacher's teacher used to say. You know, those six words used to just resonate with me, live the moment well. You know, it's a breathtaking, you know, sentence. It really is.
It's the Little Black Book of Suicide Notes, and it is available at Amazon. It's also available at AdelePaulaRoyce.com, and she is my guest here on the program. You know, you bring to mind, and I was sharing this with another individual not too long ago, where I was sitting and listening to my favorite artists. The irony is that all three of my favorite artists, of which I have a playlist on Spotify of them, on all of their albums, because I pretty much like everything that they put out, they're all dead. They all died young. Denver died, of course, at, I think it was 57. Chapin died in his late 30s. And Dan Fogelberg of cancer, I don't know how old he was. But, but for the most part, they all had basically the same message. But the real irony, as I was sharing with this person, it was that the message that they were sharing as they lived is the same damn message that we're still dealing with today. And it feels as though, kind of leading into this, we haven't learned a damn thing. We haven't moved forward. You talk about moving forward? Show me how we have moved forward as a civilization. And you know, some might say, well, then maybe there's hope. But how is there hope if there's no visual representation of some kind of forward motion? And I think that's where then, as you've talked in the first part of the program about the forward motion, I think has to start with me on the inside.
Yes, it's, as I say, it's an inside job. You need to start searching inward and finding out what makes you tick, what you're all about. You know, again, in the East, you might sit down and meditate. In the West, there's a meditation sometimes that I do that is very effective. For me, that is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going in to say, what is it all about? And you just say, well, what is what all about? And then you come up with an answer, and then you go deeper into that, and you go deeper into that. And before you know it, you're deep inside of yourself answering your own life's questions. You know, so it's not going out to any outside source. It, you know, it's not popping a pill. It's not snorting any kind of substance. It's doing something in and of yourself. And even though that sounds very narcissistic, if you look at the fact that your energy and whatever you're feeling inside of yourself is radiating out anyway, so wouldn't it make the most sense to try to be as productive and have as much hope and really be a breath of fresh air and try to find the answers to your own situation so that everyone else can start feeling a little bit better too? You know, it's just kind of a domino effect, and that's kind of what you're dealing with. So it's a very interesting subject. It needs to be spoken about a lot more, whether or not, like I said, you know, we're not in a state of inertia. I don't believe we're moving backwards. I think we're taking baby steps forward, and I think we're taking leaps forward. You know, I was always a cockeyed optimist, and I always believed in my darkest moments, and trust me, I've had some doozies. I believe that there was always a light at the end of the tunnel and kept holding on and holding on. And in some which way, shape, or manner, this book was an homage to all of, you know, that. and you come out through the other side, and it's a wonderful place to be because you do start seeing things in a totally different light. You know, I'm not saying I still don't suffer. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm a regular gal. I'm not a medical doctor. You know, I wrote a book, you know, based on life experience and what, you know, I kind of, my take on it all, you know, from my experiences. And, you know, they say to me that, you know, how much is fact versus fiction? That's the very first question that you didn't ask, but most people want to know. Well, Adele, how much of this is fact versus fiction? And it is a very interesting question, you know, question. And I say that it's fiction based on life experience, you know?
So, I mean, so what you're saying then is that you've written a book, but this doesn't mean you have all the answers.
No.
Then why
I don't
am
know
I talking?
If anybody has all the answers. I'm still searching inside of myself, and that's why we're going to go through book two, and we're going to come out in book three, and I believe that book three is going to be the piece of resistance, so to speak.
I like it. And I hope that we have the chance to talk to you at least two more times as each of these volumes come out. I also want to know, through this process in particular, and I know this took some time, how has this changed you?
I believe it's opened my heart. I believe that it really, as I spoke about it before, you know, sometimes you really don't, your heart is not really open and receptive to what is able to make it feel better, that you're not feeling in yourself enough strength to be able to give to others. And all of a sudden that, you know, that scale, that weight of justice started to shift. And my heart started opening up, and the protagonist started opening up, and the book started opening up. You know, I started feeling that vulnerability, you know, where do I end this book? How much of it is me? How much of it is her? And how much of it is chipping away? Should I end on a positive note? Should I not end on a positive note? And then an interesting thought came my way. What about taking my own advice and keep moving forward and find out what's on the other side? And then keep moving forward from there, okay? You're talking about we're still in the same spot. Well, I wanted to keep moving forward and continue the journey to come back in a new way. And that's what I decided to do. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it, Richard.
Very good. Very good. Well, I am very grateful for the opportunity to talk with you.
Oh, ditto.
About this particular subject. I can't think of anything that you know, this existence that we live today, this brief flicker, this puff of smoke that we experience, whether it's 50 years or 100 years, or if we are so lucky, unlucky, to live 150 years. And in spite of what some of the ancient wisdom teachings tell us, that some people have actually lived 900 to 1,000 years, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But this is where we are. And somehow it seems to me that we need to find a way to connect with folks who are struggling, that they do have, and I wonder if this isn't a little self-serving upon society's part, to tell them, but you do have something to contribute to society, as if society knows what it is and we want it, and don't you dare leave without giving it to us. Yeah. It also reminds me of James Redford in Celestine Prophecy, who talks about how we each have messages for one another.
Right.
And that by checking out, you deny us the opportunity to get the piece of our puzzle that you have, and for us to give you the piece of your puzzle that we have through association of at whatever level. And then the other aspect of it, too, and I think about this just when people's lives are lost through just some of the most ridiculous things that we seem to do to one another, the lost potential. What could, and it actually goes beyond, you know, you have something to contribute to society, what they could have created.
Of course.
Who they could have been. And I've even heard this argument dealing with the subject of abortion that, well, yeah, the old philosophical argument that, well, this baby was aborted and that was going to be Hitler. And this kind of stuff is like, get out of here. I don't even want to hear that. Everybody has that spark within them, no matter how deeply buried it might be.
Right.
And we have got to find a way to ignite it further, to fuel that spark in others.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's being a catalyst to start the ball rolling.
Yeah.
You know, and
it's not
an easy thing to do, but it can be done.
I think that you have begun that ball rolling with this work, The Little Black Book of Suicide Notes. Adele Paula Royce is my guest. And before I let you go, two things. One is, if you ever find yourself, I never have been able to figure out the mileage here. Is it 3,000 or 5,000 miles to the west?
Oh, I'm there all the time. I love California.
Please, if you have to be in Santa Barbara, let us know. We'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation, especially when your new works come out.
You wouldn't have to ask me twice.
All right. Wonderful. And as I mentioned earlier, I have three final questions for you that I ask all my guests. And again, thank you so much for taking so much time with us.
Oh, it's a privilege.
The first question is, who is Adele Paula Royce?
Well, let's see. I can give you a very interesting answer to that. I would say I think she's impressed and surprised that she's both the person that she always hoped she would be, but also a lot different than she ever expected.
Hmm. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
To put a smile on someone's face.
And what is your life's purpose?
To keep a smile on my face.
Very
so
good.
That I can keep, hopefully, a smile on someone else's.
Folks, go to Adele Paula Royce and check out the book, The Little Black Book of Suicide Notes. I think it will enlighten you, and we encourage you to check that out, as well as the subsequent part two and part three, if you will, of the trilogy. And Adele, thank you again for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an absolute delight, and so are you.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.